was clear from the beginning who was the superior and who the gifted lieutenant. They both came to embrace the same hard vision of war against the Confederacy and its civilians and their property. They resolved to draw on the North's superior resources, apply them sternly to the task at hand, and destroy the Southern white will to resist, even as they destroyed the capacity of the Confederate armies to remain in the field. It's inconceivable to me that the North could have won its victory as quickly, if at all, had Grant not been in place as General-in-Chief, with Sherman at his side to give the Union two really effective field commanders. Now, as I said, they both embraced a hard vision of war. As early as 1862, Sherman said, "We cannot change the hearts of the people of the South." He said this in a letter to Grant. "We can make war so terrible that they will realize its folly." During the Atlanta campaign, he told his wife that anyone who wanted to understand the realities of war should simply follow in the track of his Union Army. By the time of the Atlanta campaign, the war had aged him tremendously. He was only 42 years old. He was a chain smoker, wore a scraggly beard. His daughter at the time said that her father looked at least 60 to her. His men were devoted to him, partly because he sought to avoid unnecessary combat, something soldiers almost always appreciate. He led what would be called now an army group during this campaign against Atlanta. He had three field armies under him. The Army of the Cumberland under George H. Thomas, 60,000 men. We've seen Thomas before at Chickamauga and at Chattanooga, the Rock of Chickamauga. He commands the biggest of these three Union armies under Sherman. The second is Sherman's old army, the Army of the Tennessee, commanded now by James Birdsay McPherson. McPherson was a young officer, a man of enormous potential, and an enormously attractive young man. Virtually all of his peers saw great things in McPherson's future. He's commanding the Army of the Tennessee, 25,000 men. And finally, the Army of the Ohio, under John M. Schofield. Schofield, another young officer of great promise, an officer who would become the ranking soldier in the U.S. Army later in the 19th century. Schofield had about 15,000 men. So here is Sherman with this mighty army, three talented subordinates, and Atlanta as his focal point. Now, in his way would be the Confederate Army of Tennessee, commanded by Joseph Eggleston Johnston, about 65,000 men at the outset of the campaign, but Johnston's army would grow to more than 80,000 before the campaign reached Atlanta in July, making it the second largest army the Confederacy ever put into the field. Only Lee's army during the 7 days was larger than Johnston's in the latter stages of Johnston's command during the Atlanta campaign. We've seen Johnston many times in this course already. We saw him at First Manassas. We saw him during the Vicksburg campaign. He's a major presence on the military stage during the Civil War. He was wounded at Fair Oaks, as we know, or Seven Pines at the end of May 61, opening the way for Lee to assume command of the Army of Northern Virginia. He's a Virginian, contemporary of Lee's at West Point, had spent his entire adult life in the Army, done very well in Mexico, had a good record in the old Army, had been a Brigadier General of Staff in the old Army. Many of his men were devoted to him as well in the Army of Tennessee, not least because Johnston succeeded Braxton Bragg. That's a wonderful position to be in for any officer. If Bragg is your predecessor, you're almost certain to look better than Bragg did, and the Army welcomed Joe Johnston. His corps commanders were W.J. Hardee, perhaps the best corps commander in the Confederate Western Army, John Bell Hood, who'd been a distinguished division commander under Lee, had lost the use of one arm at Gettysburg, had lost a leg at the hip at Chickamauga, a terrible wound at Chickamauga. The third corps commander was Bishop General Leonidas Polk. Now, Johnston was a defensive-minded officer for the most part. I believe he was deeply envious of Lee. Lee always seemed to be one step ahead of Johnston. Johnston masked that well from Lee, but revealed it in his letters and later in things he wrote after the war. Very jealous of his rank, uncommunicative with Jefferson Davis. He did not keep Davis informed well about his plans and what he was doing. And I think he was a man who in many ways did not understand his position in a democratic society at war. Didn't understand it certainly as well as Lee did. And the necessity to keep your civilian superiors well informed, the necessity to pay attention to what the expectations of the people behind the lines were, I don't think those were strong points with Johnston.